Hi there, and welcome to New Books in South Asian Studies. I'm your host, Ian Cook, and today we're talking about Patronage as Politics in South Asia, edited by Anastasia Pilyovsky. The book is published by Cambridge University Press in 2014, and Anastasia is a Newton Leverhulme Early Career Fellow at CRASH and a Fellow and Director of Studies at Girton College at the University of Cambridge. Now, does patronage always imply a corruption of democratic political processes? Across 16 essays by historians, political scientists, and anthropologists, this book explores this question and many more across a range of historical and cultural contexts. The volume's collective drive to ask difficult and theoretically nuanced questions about the role of patronage in South Asia gives the book a coherence that plays wonderfully against the contribution's eclecticism and diversity. I had the pleasure of speaking with Anastasia just a few moments before. Okay, so it gives me great pleasure to welcome Anastasia to New Books in South Asian Studies. Patronage in politics is by and large viewed as problematic, both in academic and in popular discourse. But in calling your book Patronage as Politics in South Asia, it's a way for you to really critically interrogate this assumption. So I was wondering, for the first question, to give us an idea of the big argument of your book, could you please tell us like what looking at patronage in the region teaches us about the way politics works?
Well, thank you, Ian, so much for having me with you. And thank you for such a big question. I'm afraid it requires quite a big answer, which I'll do my best to give. Well, I think that to understand politics, we really need to understand how people who are involved in this politics think. So more specifically, I think we need to understand what these people expect from one another, what they think these other people and they themselves should do, what they should be like. I think we need to understand what to these people we are looking at makes for an authoritative person, for a legitimate, a good or bad leader. And also we need to understand the ideas and values, the categories and values that motivate their decision judgments, the ideas that really steer what people do. So all of this should be rather obvious, rudimentary stuff, right? To understand how stuff works, we need to understand how people is that academics who are trained in the Euro-American ways of political thinking have got very firm ideas of their own about all these things, about what politicians should be like, what they should do, what political relations should be like, what is and isn't reasonable to expect within politics, and so on. Now, I think our own political ideas are rooted in three basic values, or rather beliefs, that we have. The first of these is something we can think of as detachment, or something that manifests itself in the detachment of the bureaucratic process, the impersonality of it, and of law. And this is one of the cornerstones of our ideas about good governance or of political justice. So we think that politicians and bureaucrats shouldn't do favors to particular persons, but they should rather be following proper procedural rules, which make them not discriminate between people. When they start to discriminate, and when they give jobs to their uncles or tax breaks to their nephews, we call it corruption, right? Now, the second belief is one in individual autonomy, by which we mean that all people who are involved in politics should make political choices freely on the basis of a rational deliberation and fully on their own terms, independently of any kind of relations that they might be involved in. So during elections, of course, the enclosure of the voting booth is really meant to assist that freedom, to separate people from outside influences, as we call them, and to create a kind of autonomous, solitary moment for their political choice. And the third belief, and I think that's the most important and fundamental one, is in equality. So we believe that good politics and good governance really rest on basic human equality, or rather should rest on basic human equality. So not just equality among citizens of a country or among voters, but among voters and people whom they elect to political office. So our sense of political representation, for instance, I think rests in this belief in equality, in the belief that political representatives are people who are authorized to speak on our behalf because they are in some way like us. Either because, you know, they're women just like us, or ethnic minorities just like us, or more commonly and simply because we feel that we can identify with their convictions. So representatives are people we identify with. That's how we tend to think about it. Now, there's nothing wrong with any of these ideas as such. In fact, they've been extremely important to some of the most remarkable political processes and transformations of modernity. But what is a problem is that these normative ideas, right, ideas about what should be, come to be used as categories for analysis. When analysts in academia and in the press, or people sitting around kitchen tables talking about politics, start mixing assertions of their own beliefs with attempts to understand the lives of other people. So when analysis becomes displaced by judgment, by judgment of other people's ideas through the moral standards that we ourselves have inherited through particular history and through particular cultural environments. So when we do this, when we judge other people through our own moral categories, politics in most of the world include not just, you know, funny places like India, but including countries like Britain or Germany or the United States of America, starts to look very disconcerting. It looks utterly corrupt, even criminal in some cases, and ultimately pretty incomprehensible in any but the most dismal of terms. So if we start not from these beliefs of our own, but rather from questions. So from questions rather than answers about ideas that shape people's political lives, I think things may appear not only a little less blanketly grim, but also much more interesting and perhaps even more instructive about politics, not just in South Asia, but I think in places that many of us who live in Euro-American places call home. So that's really the start of this book. It starts from these very simple questions about what people think about their political lives in South Asia. And the answers that the book provides, which come from many different angles, from people who work on medieval Tibet to people who work on Carolan migrants to the Middle East, and people all over India, Pakistan and Bangladesh, the answers that it provides come from some shared observations of a very different way of thinking that we collectively as contributors to the book have seen, have heard, have experienced in India. Very different ways of thinking about political roles and political relations, ideas which I have collectively called patronage, right? So these, of course, aren't only political ideas that people entertain in South Asia. They're not the only things that people think, and they're not uncontested ideas. But they are very widespread, and some of the contributors show, especially the ones who go further into history, that they've been important to the politics of the region for a very long time. The set of ideas which I've called patronage, they involve, I think, three, again, fundamental beliefs, which are rather in conflict with our own beliefs, which I've named earlier, about detachment, individual autonomy, and equality. So the first belief in this morality of patronage is the belief in personal attachments, as opposed to detachment. So in bonds between people being a very good and valuable thing, perhaps indeed the most valuable thing in social life. And this belief underpins the idea that in politics, personal relations, very particular relations, are not really a sign of corruption, but rather the right and proper foundation for political life. So people tend to think that political leaders should be personally involved in the lives of their constituents. So when we meet politicians, what they're usually doing are something that isn't to do with legislating, but rather with helping particular people out in particular ways, and they proudly call themselves social workers. When you talk to British MPs, they complain about being denigrated to the status of social workers. They say, oh, you know, we should really be in Parliament legislating, and instead we're helping this girl get her council housing, or we're helping so-and-so with their visa, and so on. But in India, people proudly say, look, I've helped this person, I've helped that person, and so on. So they're personally involved, and people think that they should be, that they should help them, that they should be generous to them, and not just be sort of accountable to them in an abstract way, but rather responsible for their lives. So people will come, I don't have enough money. They expect elected political leaders to provide for them, and they often do as much as they can. Now, so the second idea is the idea of mutual dependence. So instead of individual autonomy, which is so central to the Euro-American way of thinking, here we have the idea of mutual dependence, which is the basis of trust and responsibility in political relations. And the third idea, and I think this one is the most perplexing for Westerners who encounter this way of thinking, is inequality rather than equality as the basis for good relations between people who govern and then people whom they govern. So this idea is that political leaders mustn't be like us, but they must be bigger, higher standing people, what I've called patrons, or in South Asian literature, but also in broader anthropological literature, anthropologists have called big men. So they should have more money, more power, more status. They should be more than us. And it's precisely because they're grander people, because they're grandees, that they can have so much more responsibility than ordinary folk. So the idea is that they shouldn't be like us. They should be bigger than us, and therefore they should have more responsibility. And responsibility of a more intense sort. So not just responsibility to us, but also responsibility for us. Okay? So if we understand these ideas, I think we can understand why, for example, many people in South Asia don't really think of corruption in the way that, say, Transparency International presents it to us. They don't think of it as the misuse of public office for private gain, but rather as the politician's failure to be attentive enough or generous enough to their people. So if you and I might see embezzlement as corruption, in India, many people see it as corrupt only if the person who's embezzling is not really sharing enough with their followers, right? It's fine to embezzle as long as you do it, not just for yourself, but also for other people who depend on you. Now, the piece by Pamela Price in the book is especially good on this alternative sense of corruption, but it runs through several other pieces as well. Now, so if we step out from our own world of detachment, autonomy, equality, into the world of attachment, dependence, and inequality, I think we might get a better sense of politics, not just in South Asia, but also other parts of the world. So take, for instance, the United States at the moment, right? A hotbed of thinking about what the hell democracy is all about, and how we can understand it. Now, I think that liberal commentators often seem confused about the reasons for Trump's election. So they say, how could people who live in trailer parks in the south of the United States choose a man from the Golden Tower from Manhattan? Right? He's so unequal to them. How can they possibly think that he can represent their interests if he's so unlike them? Right? Also, you know, how can born-again Christians vote for such a loose figure? Right? So if we think through ideas of equality as the basis of identification, how indeed? But if we think that maybe there's a different basis, which might not have to do with equality, but rather with the sense that we've described in the book as the basis for choosing your leader, it might just begin to make more sense.
Mm-hmm. Wonderful, wonderful. I wonder, that sets us up really well to discuss the rest of the book, and also it's got me thinking about lots of things, not I mean, the book got me thinking, and this has got me thinking even more about the world around us now. But before we turn to the book in depth, I was wondering first, could you please tell us a little bit about yourself? What's your academic background and what led you to want to conceive and edit this collection?
Yes, well, I'll start a little bit before my academic life, just to say that I was never interested in politics at all. I grew up in the Soviet Union, and in the Soviet Union, decent people were not interested in politics. My parents are both artists, and although, you know, I was brought up in a sort of fiercely Marxist egalitarian ethic, politics was always something from a different world, not from ours. It's something that people who had no morals did. Right, it's a sense that's shared by quite a lot of people in the world, but it was very intensely so in the Soviet Union. Now, when I was an adolescent, I moved to the United States, and I became interested in culture, in the way that people think about their lives and how they live them. And so I studied as an anthropologist, as an undergraduate student. I ended up studying anthropology at Boston University in the United States. I've also, for the same reason of interest about how people imagine their lives, I've had an interest in religion, which was my other major at BU. I even dabbled in Sanskrit studies at one point for a very short time. And then I won a Rhodes Scholarship, which took me to Oxford, where I did my master's and doctoral degrees, which were both in social anthropology. Now, the idea for this book was born really during my doctoral field research, which I was doing among a cast of professional thieves who are called hunters and who live in the North Indian state of Rajasthan, where I've done most of my field work. So while I was there, I ended up sitting ringside to lots and lots of political debates, some of them very, very heated, some getting very nearly violent. And I witnessed one round of state assembly elections in Rajasthan. This was in 2008, which actually forms the basis for what I've written about in the book's chapter that I've contributed. And what struck me was that many of the ways that people thought and talked about politics were just had nothing to do with what I read in books and articles about Indian politics before I went to India. You know, I wasn't studying politics, and I wasn't particularly interested in it as such. But, you know, I read stuff on South Asia, quite a lot of it, and I'm interested in more popular writings on the region. And what I saw there in so many ways was just so different from what people were writing. And this book is sort of a small step in the direction of trying to convey the sense of politics that I experienced in India to an academic, to a Western audience, to an Anglophone audience. And that's something that I'm now gotten much more involved in and working on various projects which are doing just that as well.
Okay, great. That gives us a good sense of yourself. So now let's go back to the book. And the book is split into three different sections. The idea of patronage in South Asia, the second is democracy as patronage, and finally, prospects and disappointments. So let's look at one contribution from each of the sections. So the first section, I want to talk about Sumit Guha's chapter, and he explores a chapter called, his chapter is called Patronage and State Making in Early Modern Empires in India and Britain. So I was wondering, what does his chapter tell us about the importance of power and wealth when thinking about patronage?
Yeah, thanks, Ian. So several pieces in the book, and Sumit's piece is certainly one of them, remind us that the hierarchical, patronage-focused political order that we have described isn't just about ideas, of course. It's a political order, and it requires it involves power, and it requires resources. What his piece reminds us of, I think, is that the patronal relations, in order to realize the ideals inherent in them, especially the ideal of generosity, they require resources, often very substantial resources. So the patron figure's sort of defining responsibility, right, is to be generous and to give, to provide for their people. So as somebody told Arild Rood, who is one of the contributors to the volume, you need to be a businessman nowadays to be a politician, right? So if previously political leaders had their own lands, had their own taxes, had their own wealth that they could then redistribute, and we know from historical studies of kingship in South Asia that that kind of generous redistribution, sometimes over-generous redistribution, was really the core of polities in South Asia. Now politicians need to get that money from somewhere if they don't come from grand aristocratic lineages and so on. So many of them do run businesses. Now, this kind of need for acquisition of resources and their lavish redistribution puts the entire system in tension with itself, because the ideal of generosity, of selfless generosity, stands very much at odds with the self-interested acquisition of money, of means, that politicians really must engage in order to be able to provide it, right? And the piece by David Gilmartin, which I think is one of the finest pieces in the volume, is really excellent on this. He describes this tension in great detail and how it worked out through the early, late 19th and early 20th century in India and Pakistan. So Shumit Guha makes another striking point about what makes and breaks patronal relations. Now, what he shows is that the patronal systems he describes in 18th century West India, so that was both the Maratha polity as well as the East India Company, which was operating in the same area. So it's very interesting because he's linking it to British structures of of political affiliation with the Maratha structures. And what he's showing is that in both instances, the system of this well-working order of patronal relations relied on constant personal engagement, on a sort of a system of favors, which were perceived as personal favors. And whenever it ossified into a regimented system of formal entitlement, the whole thing fell apart. So what I think he shows is that this paternal order that we've described can't really work without it being personal, right? It has to remain that. And whenever it forms a formal hierarchy, it just, the point of it disappears.
Wonderful. Thanks for that. Now, the second section has actually the one you just mentioned, and also a couple of other excellent contributions by people who previously appeared on New Books in South Asia, like Lisa Bjorkman and Pamela Price as well. But seeing as you have a chapter in that section, let's focus on your chapter, which is centered on rural Rajasthan, and the chapter is called India's Demiotic Democracy and its Depravities in the Ethnographic Long Durée. So my question here, and it's a bit like my first question, like a very big question, but I was wondering, what role does morality play in political practices and decisions?
Thanks, Ian. So my chapter, as I said, is about the 2008 elections to the Rajasthan Legislative Assembly, which I witnessed and documented as much as I could when I was doing my doctoral fieldwork. And I show in the chapter that the old local idea that patrons as big men should be generous is really central to the way that people nowadays judge politicians and make their electoral choices in the democratic process. So morality, or the values through which people form their judgments, is really crucial for understanding this process. So people don't just accept, what I thought was interesting is that people don't just accept everything that politicians give them as a positive patronal gift. So, right, the political analysts oftentimes say that, well, these huge feasts that politicians throw, the various, you know, saris that they distribute, are sort of by voters' favor. Well, what I've found out is that they don't actually buy voters' favor unless they're judged as morally sound. And there's a very complex moral process of judging, of making a decision about what something means in moral terms, because, you know, a gift is a gift, you know, in economic terms. I mean, a sari is a sari. But people distinguish very, very sharply between things that look like they've been given selfishly and instrumentally, right? Like things that have been given in order to buy your vote, to buy your allegiance, and gifts that were given from the heart, as they say, which signal the politician's willingness to be their man, to have ongoing loyalty to them. There's a lot of disagreement about how exactly to judge these gifts that politicians give, but the principle of selfless generosity remains the shared kind of standard of judgment. So there's an interesting story that I tell in the piece about a husband and a wife who are offered a gift of cash from a politician, sort of sends young boys in the quite late in the night in order to give it to them, and how they react differently to this donation and the sort of the brawl that ensues between the husband and the wife, because one takes one position and the other one another position, and it's very much a moral disagreement between whether they should take it and why not.
Mm-hmm. Okay, this is known as I'm remembering that anecdote when I read it. The final section of the book looks at the limits of what we might want to still call patronage. That's like when it breaks down and blurs into something else. And there's a few chapters here which do that. But I want to talk about Nicholas Martin's chapter. So my question is, what's the dark side of patronage, as he calls it, in the Pakistani Punjab?
Right. So I think it's important to remember that patronage in itself isn't a good system. It isn't any better than any other, and it isn't in itself, you know, something that I endorse as a political or moral good. I think to make the moral logic of this legible, which is what we try in the book, is not at all the same as to endorse it as a moral good, right? Which some of the readers of the book can mistake us. The book is saying that, and I think it's really important that we don't, you know, blur the two purposes. Now, patronage can and always disintegrate into exploitation, right? So when bonds of mutual dependence are severed, and when people who are involved in a relationship are no longer bound by mutual responsibility to one another, patronage turns into bare inequality, grabbing, gaining, abuse, even slavery that Nico Martin described in his chapter, or a sort of bonded, you know, cycles of indebtedness and bonded labor and endless misery that can last for many generations. Now, this kind of thing has happened all over South Asia in recent history. And I think it happens wherever relations between landholders and laborers have been disrupted, and wherever the landholders depend patrons to depend for their political influence, for the security of their income, not on people who are below them, their laborers, but rather on something above them. So like the government of British India, right, or even state law, which access to which in South Asia isn't evenly distributed, right, but rather it's more accessible to people who are more influential, who are wealthier, right? So when that becomes the source of power, of influence, of authority, as well as of financial security, bonds of dependence on people below you, or rather dependence on people below you, starts to disintegrate. And the very thing that makes patronage a moral ideal, that responsibility not only of people below to people above, but also of people above to people below, disappears. And I think we can no longer talk about this trend. And the mistake that I think a lot of political analysts make when they see unequal relations of any sort as patronage is precisely that they don't see that one is inequality, injustice, and exploitation, and the other infused with a sense of responsibility and delivering on the sense of responsibility. And that is very fragile, of course, and vulnerable to particular political and economic circumstances.
Thanks so much for that. As we were mentioning before we started recording, I really enjoyed this book. It gives you so much to think about. It gives you so much to think about, not only in terms of South Asia, but I think in other parts of the world as well. I'm thinking about it in terms of Eastern Europe and in Hungary and the sort of corruption scandals that are going on here. I think, like you mentioned, also Trump as well. And it makes us rethink questions of democracy and inequality and all these things very well. So I'd urge people to check out the book. One of the problems that we always have on New Books in South Asian Studies is we get, you know, very deep and rich books, and then we only get a time to talk about a few of the contributions. So I was wondering if there's anything that you would like to highlight that I've not asked with my questions today. And then also, could you please also tell us a little bit about what current projects you're working on now?
Yes, Ian. I think it's especially true of a book that has 16 chapters that we can only touch on a few things.
I should mention it doesn't fit through my letterbox. So I have
to... Yes, it's a doorstop sort of book. But I think one chapter that is absolutely dazzling, and it's the first chapter in the book, is by Matteson Mines. In fact, it's the last thing he published before he very suddenly and very sadly passed away just last year. Matteson, of course, was a real pioneer of work on hierarchy and on patronage, on what he called the politics of big men, which set out the idea of hierarchy not as an ossified pyramid-like structure that we've got from Dumont, but rather as a system of thinking about life that is very much mobile, that's full of individual pursuits, aspirations, decisions that people make. That's really the foundation of real human life. So read that chapter. It's wonderful. Also, as I said, David Gilmartin's piece is wonderful. Ward Berenshot has a very fine study of fixers who are, as South Asianists have now come to accept, are a very central part of politics in South Asia. But how it is that fixers become patrons and patrons become fixers is very interesting, and it's outlined in that. Beatrice Jauregui has a fantastic chapter on the way that the logic of patronage operates in the way that police work in northern India. And Lucia Micheluti writes about sort of king-like, often criminal political figures in northern India. Really worth a read. And I think the final chapter really takes us beyond the shores of South Asia and is a wonderfully provocative piece by Philippa Osella, one of the absolutely finest in the book. It's about the way that the patronage and mediation work in the movement of Indians, and especially Keralans, to and from the Gulf. And it really throws it into a much more global perspective than some of the pieces. Mm-hmm. I have really worked on a couple of things that this book starts off. The first is hierarchy, right, as a broad concept of relating vertically through inequality, through mutual dependence, and also on just bringing the sense of the sense of politics into that is South Asian into our understanding. So I'm now in the final stages of writing a book about hierarchy as a source of social mobility. We tend to think of it as a roadblock to social mobility, but actually the book argues that it can be a very powerful mobilizer, enabler of people's movements and their aspirations. So it's based on the research I've done with this cast of professional thieves, which I mentioned earlier, and the provisional title is Hierarchy as Hope. Let's hope it comes out next year. I'm also writing a book on Indian democracy as a profoundly hierarchical political practice. Of course, it develops the theme of the patronage book. And I think what I'm trying to do is to cast the argument beyond South Asia more explicitly this time around, and think through what seeing Indian democracy as both a very successful democracy, one that engages its populace in the political process, and at the same time very hierarchical in its imaginative base, what it teaches us about democracy as such, what we think democracy is, and the shape that it should take. So I'm also editing a volume with a couple of anthropologists who are not South Asianists. One is Joel Robbins, who's an anthropologist working in Papua New Guinea, and an anthropologist called Vita Peacock, who works in Germany. So the volume we're editing is called Hierarchy, Egalitarianism, and Responsibility. And it's a collection of work by anthropologists who are working all over the world. And it interrogates the current crisis of what we think to be a crisis of political and economic responsibility as a distinctive problem of egalitarianism. Okay. And I'm also editing a special issue for modern Asian studies, which is about the moral underpinnings of political criminalization in South Asia, or what South Asians nowadays tend to call gundaraj, the rule of gangsters or goons. And the final project is something I'm just starting out with Lisa Mitchell, who is a historian and an anthropologist based at UPenn, whom we started hosting a series of conversations that involve historians, Sanskritists, literary scholars, as well as anthropologists. And the conversations are meant to start mapping out the vernacular vocabularies or lexicons that are used by people in South Asia to talk about politics and to communicate within politics. So again, it's an attempt to bring the local sense of political life into the academic discussion, and to start really thinking about Indian politics in terms through concepts that are much more appropriate to it than the kind of global language of concepts that we have inherited from Western political theory.
Wonderful. They all sound like really fascinating projects. We look forward to reading those soon. Or a little bit later for some of the other ones. Looking forward to them. There's nothing much more for me to do today apart from to thank you again for coming on New Books in South Asian Studies. I really enjoyed reading the book, and it's been great to speak with you about it today.
Thank you, Ian. It was wonderful.
Thanks so much for downloading the New Books in South Asian Studies podcast. I've been your host, Ian Cook, and today we've been talking about Patronage's Politics in South Asia, edited by Anastasia Pilyavsky. I really hope you enjoyed our conversation as much as I did, and hope you check out the book itself. It's absolutely excellent. Thanks again for listening, and hope you tune in again next time. Ta-ra!